Hello and welcome to The Rules of Investing. I'm your host, David Thornton. Today's guest is Mary Manning, Portfolio Manager for the Alphinity Global Fund and Alphinity Global Sustainable Fund. Mary's been investing in global markets for over 20 years, with stints at Elliston Capital, Oaktree Capital, and Soros Fund Management. In today's episode, we discuss the world opening up, divergence in big tech, sustainability and AI, and we even dive into the political tinderbox that is Taiwan and what it means for markets. If you're an Apple Podcast or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a Livewire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of the wire to get notified whenever we post new content. Not a Livewire subscriber yet? Head over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free to sign up and you'll get access to the leading investment minds from Australia and abroad. Mary, thanks for coming on Rules of Investing.
Hi, David. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Alphinity is back on the road. How's it been? And what are you hearing from management?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. As you know, people couldn't really travel at all during COVID. So there was about a 2-year period there where we didn't have a lot of travel overseas and we didn't have a lot of one-on-one meetings with people. But certainly that has changed a lot in the last 6 months. So me and my colleagues, we've done 9 overseas trips between us and over 200 in-person meetings with companies. And so, yeah, it's been absolutely fantastic to get back to that one-on-one. You get a lot more out of those kind of meetings. So I guess in terms of overall takeaways from all this travel. One would be that, you know, the US, there's a lot going on in the US right now. And, you know, I cover consumer stocks and there's a lot of question marks around the US consumer and where they're going. So I did a big trip to New York and Canada earlier this year. And one of the takeaways is that the low-end consumer is not in as good a position as the high-end consumer. So in the portfolio, we have a strong preference for companies like LVMH or Mercedes that are clearly at that high end. So that's been the right way to be positioned. And that was very clear from the trip. I guess another takeaway is that, you know, there is an energy crisis in Europe. And me and a lot of my colleagues have met with companies in Europe. And, you know, there's still question marks around the Ukraine. It's not getting nearly as much airtime as it was a few months ago. But certainly as we move into Europe, or into winter for Europe, there's a lot of concern that if, you know, gas gets cut off to Germany, and that's a huge industrial hub for Europe and for the world, that there's going to be some implications there. And then I guess lastly, you know, me and my colleague, we have gone to San Francisco and New York and to Seattle. And there's been a big divergence in the FANG companies recently. And so, you know, in Seattle, I met with Amazon and met with Microsoft and the sort of divergence in pathways of those companies. And then certainly you have the losers among the FANGs like Netflix. There's been a very big divergence there. So meeting with them one-on-one just highlighted the facts that these companies are not on the same trajectory anymore.
Yeah, on the one hand, you have the Netflix, and then you have the Amazons, you have the Apples. What is separating those two groups? Because they are, like you say, very divergent.
Yeah, I think it's important to go back and think about the environment when the FANGs got their name. So the first thing, which is a very superficial point, but you can't even talk about FANGs anymore because Facebook is now Meta and Google is Alphabet. So like FANG doesn't even make sense at an acronym level, but it also doesn't make sense in terms of like why they got the acronym in the first place, which is that you had all these big tech companies that were very high growth and that were all sort of trading in a similar thematic. That this was the, you know, there's a structural growth story in technology. And then I think COVID sort of messed a lot of that up because within the FANGs, you had some companies which were huge beneficiaries of COVID. Netflix is probably the poster child there where you had years worth of demand get pulled through during COVID. And then afterwards, you know, a lot of that needs to be given back. So, you know, Microsoft, for example, there wasn't that same level of pull forward where you had, you know, the cloud business certainly did better than it would have without COVID. But you can sort of break the FANGs into companies that had huge COVID pull forward and then companies that didn't. I think the second thing, which is leading to a divergence, is ESG. And so we've actually never held Facebook, or we haven't in this, you know, this last few years period, because our ESG analysis showed that Facebook is very high risk. And, you know, we have a certain label for ESG risk where we don't invest in those kind of companies. And if you look at the ESG, particularly on the governance and the data privacy of an Apple versus a Facebook, it is absolutely night and day. And so, you know, Facebook was kind of in the doghouse from an ESG perspective, and that ended up being alpha generative because that led to a lot of problems with Facebook. Two other things I'll highlight. One is earnings. So, you know, at Alphinity, we follow earnings leadership. So you're looking at companies that are in a beat and raise cycle. And that has been very clearly evident in how the FANGs have traded, because you have like the Facebooks of the world and Netflix, and for a couple of quarters, Amazon, that were missing earnings like quite significantly. And certainly for Facebook and for Netflix, they were missing users and some of the drivers of revenue and drivers of earnings. Whereas you've had companies like Apple and Microsoft until very recently that, regardless of what was going on in the environment, they were in a very, very strong beat and raise cycle. So I think that sort of quantitatively has certainly been the biggest divergence. And then the last thing I'll mention, and you know, I get the question a lot. So like, when do you start bottom fishing for some of these? And particularly the losers, is it time to switch out of the winners and into the losers? I think that in this broader sort of tech space, there's a lot of business models that aren't going to make it. So actually, LiveWire, you guys asked me to do a once in a lifetime buying opportunity thing. And so I sorted all of the tech companies and all of the internet companies, and the ones at the bottom, whether it's like Carvana or Snap or some of these ones that, you know, until this recent rally were down 70-80%. Like, I don't know if the business model is going to make it. And so back to your question about FANGs, within that, I mean, there's no question that the Apple business model is going to be sustained, or Microsoft. But there's still a little bit of a question mark around Netflix. The streaming wars, you know, it has just killed their business. There's a little bit of question mark around Facebook and whether this whole shift towards Meta is actually a good long-term strategic thing, or whether it's a sort of cover-up for the fact that Facebook's core business, you know, isn't growing. And, you know, unless you're over 45, nobody actually wants to use Facebook. And so I think when you're looking at those big tech companies and the former FANGs, determining whether their earnings are still in a beat and raise cycle, whether they have good ESG, and whether their business models have staying power, I think those are the three differentiating factors.
Last podcast episode discussed valuation of these companies, and whether it's a problem that these big tech, long duration, reinvesting type stocks are valued based on revenue as opposed to profit. How do you think about that? Is it, you mentioned earnings just before as the key metric that you look at?
Yeah, this is an excellent point, and I should have brought it up before in terms of, if you look at these big tech companies, the FANGs that I mentioned before, and FANGs plus Microsoft, you know, and NVIDIA is sometimes lumped in there as well, they all have earnings. None of these are unprofitable tech companies. And so you can value them on earnings. And some of the big ones like Microsoft and, you know, Google is one of our big positions. It's trading at 20 times PE. And when you think about what you're getting for 20 times PE in terms of the moat around that business and the cash flows, or if you like look at Apple and don't think of it as a tech company, think of it as a consumer company, what you're getting for, you know, 26, 27 times PE in terms of the brand and the cash flow, those are very, very attractive valuations. Where we don't invest, and, you know, certainly that's been the right place to be recently, is in these unprofitable techs, where you are buying something on price to revenues and they don't have earnings, and there is, you know, they're kind of like hope and pray business model type investments. You know, those companies can perform very well in a sort of raging bull market where people don't care about valuation. But, you know, in this rising interest rate sort of environment where people are starting to look at value, or, you know, have started to look at valuation, and where those sort of metrics are important, there's no downside support for these unprofitable techs. And I think that's why, you know, people call this a tech wreck 2.0, because it really has been for a lot of these companies that are down 50% more this year. And if you have a company that's trading on, you know, 10 to 15 times price to revenues, and they're trading at 1,000 times PE, or they have negative earnings, and it goes down 50%, you're still not at a valuation floor. You're still not pounding the table saying, I'm 100% sure in this valuation I'm going to buy here. There's just no floor at all. And so staying in those very high quality companies that have the good cash flows, that have net cash so they can continue to buy back their shares if it falls, where there's sort of a line in the sand, like, you know, 18 times for Google would sort of be my line in the sand, where as long as the earnings are intact, you know, that's a very attractive price. I think that's an important differentiation between those unprofitable tech and the big high quality tech.
Have these stocks only become attractive post-sell-off? Can they be attractive at these sky-high PEs? And if we get there again, you know, could the valuations be fair? Is there such a thing to have these PEs that are just astronomically high and still, you know, be worth buying?
So I would say for the big tech companies, I would argue that their PEs aren't sky high. They're quite attractive right now. If you look at, you know, the absolute level of PE, the relative level of PE versus their peers and also versus their own trading history. And then for a lot of growth stocks, you know, people use a PEG ratio. So what is the PE versus the growth that you're getting? And for some of these stocks that have, you know, very consistent, sustainable double digit EPS growth, to pay a 1.5-2 times PEG for them is not expensive at all. So for some of that large end, you know, high quality mega cap tech, I would argue that the PE is actually relatively attractive right now. For the sort of more spivvy end, a lot of it depends on what's happening with interest rates. So we have, you know, some companies like Tesla is an example of a quasi tech company where for a long time it was hard to value it on PE because it was trading at, you know, triple digit PE. And, you know, what does that mean versus a market that's trading at 21 times PE? And so I use DCF to value that. And I use it a DCF with a sum of the parts because you obviously have the core auto business, which is, you can touch it, you can feel it, you can, it's not easy, but it's relatively easy to do valuation of that. And then you have some of these other businesses, whether it's full self-driving, the autonomous driving, or some of the energy or mobility, that it's quite hard to put a specific number on it right now. But you can try doing it via DCF and then come up with a sum of the parts. But the issue with some of these businesses when you're using a DCF to value businesses which may or may not be profitable right now is that they're very sensitive to what you use as your WACC assumption. And so I think part of the problem why you saw such a huge sell-off in tech and some of these...
Sorry, Mary, what's a WACC assumption?
Oh, WACC. Okay, sorry. We'll step back a little bit. It's your weighted average cost of capital. So if you're doing a DCF, you need to discount those cash flows back, and the WACC is your discount rate. And so the basis of your discount rate is typically the US 10-year. And so when the US 10-year was, you know, when the whole world practically, or most of the developed worlds was at zero interest rate, that WACC, what you're discounting at, was a very, very low number. But as the US 10-year started to rise, and certainly when it got around 3% or over 2.5% where it is now, that number that you're using to discount all those cash flows is going up. And your ultimate valuation can be very, very sensitive to what you stick in for that WACC number. So anyone who is valuing these unprofitable companies or companies that were sort of in early stages of their life cycle using a discount model, when the 10-year is going up and when interest rates are going up, your value is sort of by definition coming down. So that's what made it hard earlier this year to do those kind of valuations.
Okay, let's segue from the US to China. And in doing so, I'd love to explore the geopolitical competition between the two. And of course, the epicenter of that at the moment is Taiwan. First, Nancy Pelosi paid a visit, then China conducted military drills, sent a couple of missiles over the island. And then more recently, Democratic Senator Ed Markey took a 5-person delegation there. Where does this tit for tat end?
I mean, I don't think it's going to end in our lifetime. I guess that's the first point. I mean, if you, I know your background, you'd be well aware of this, but a lot of the academic research on hegemonic decline, and if you look way back over the, you know, the history of mankind, you know, empires rise and fall. And for many years now, there's been a theory out there that the US is in hegemonic decline and China is rising. And, you know, I'm not going to make a call on whether that's true or whether they're going to cross paths and China will become the hegemon or whether we're moving to a sort of more, you know, world with two superpowers. But the point is that if you look throughout history, it's very, very consistent that if you have a challenging power and a declining power, there's going to be conflict. How serious that conflict is another question, but there's going to be conflict on that path. And so I don't think there's ever going to be a situation or a, you know, complete calm in China and the US stop competing with each other. That said, I guess there's a couple things to highlight that are important about China right now. The first is it is really hard to figure out what's going on the ground in China. So for most of my career, you know, I spent a lot of my career doing emerging markets and focused on Asia. And I would generally go to China at least 2 times a year, maybe more if there was a lot going on. And I haven't been since the middle of 2019. And so there's no, let's go to the ground and, you know, kick the tires and figure out what's really going on. Like, I don't know. It's hard to tell. The second thing is that within China, there's been quite a crackdown in terms of how comfortable people feel talking about what's going on. So I had a call a few weeks ago, and It was a Zoom call. The person was in China. And I asked him a question about Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang. And he said, I don't say first names on Zoom. And it wasn't even a bad question. It wasn't even a, like, say something negative about these people. It was just a very plain question about the political situation in China. And he would not answer it saying first names. And, you know, you see that also from some of the brokers in China. You send them a message on Bloomberg saying, you know, why is Tencent down 5%? And they say, I'll call you back on my mobile. And so in that sort of environment where I can't go there and kick the tires myself, and you're very unsure about what kind of information you're getting from people who are on the ground, I don't know. It's a much cloudier sort of environment than it has been in the past.
How dangerous is it these days for Western companies to operate in China? When does it get to the point that political risk is just too high and the juice isn't worth the squeeze?
So I think that certainly from a consumer perspective and from a technology perspective and from Australia's perspective in terms of resources, the juice is almost always worth the squeeze. I mean, I get this question a lot. Is China like uninvestable? You just can't do business there and you can't invest there. I mean, it's the largest country in the world, population wise, and it's the second largest economy, or even by some metrics, it already is the largest economy in the world. And if you add up A shares and Hong Kong and the Chinese ADRs, it's top three equity market in the world. So to say, you know, it's the largest consumer market in the world, and despite everything that's going on, it's one of the fastest growing consumer markets in the world. You can't just, it's too hard, it's too risky, it's not happening. I don't think that's a realistic approach to China. So I think, I don't have a strong view from a multinational perspective, but you haven't seen any multinationals pull out of China. You've seen almost every single one of them pull out of Russia, but, no one has pulled out of China. And I've actually had this discussion.
They're just in there and they're not using first names.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that was a one-off, but I guess my point is that it's, you know, many times I've come on Livewire or discuss with you and your colleagues a very strong view about China, and you're pounding the table. This is not a pound the table sort of environment, because I'll be totally honest, you just don't know. So back to your question though about Taiwan, I think it's important to highlight that the midterms are coming up in the US. So the context of what's going on in China and Taiwan is important. So there's really only one thing that Democrats and Republicans can agree on, and that's that neither of them like China. And so it's not surprising at all that during this timing, why did Pelosi choose to go to Taiwan at this time? I don't think if there were midterms coming up, she would have picked that exact date. And the second delegation that you talked about, it's, you know, same thing for them. And so I think it's a little bit more posturing to do with the U.S. Political cycle than it is to do that something has changed with respect to Taiwan. I mean, my takeaway from what's happened in Taiwan is sort of the way that they responded, and to do that, you know, there was this, it's been called a blockade or a quasi blockade around Taiwan. That's really quite important, because it shows that there's an avenue in there that's not war, it's not conflict, but it could cause a lot of problems in the world. And as you know, and as I've discussed with Livewire many times before, the predominance of Taiwan in the semiconductor industry means if you had any kind of blockade where semis couldn't get out of Taiwan, like the whole world, that could cause a lot of problems. So that's the situation.
China has really weaponized trade. That's one of the levers it really has these days. Whether or not it's effective, but with a blockade, that's really taking weaponized trade to a new level, far beyond things like tariffs.
It is, but I would actually push back. I think Trump weaponized trade. I mean, like, he started it. So I think, yeah, if you look back to sort of where Chinese-U.S. relations were in the pre-Trump era, weaponization of trade was not happening. In fact, since China got into the WTO in, I think it was around 2000, that trade relationship has actually been improving quite significantly. And then it was only when Trump got in and he had this make America great again and let's reshore everything and I want American jobs and the anti-China sentiment, that's when the weaponization of trade started happening. And I guess one of the disappointments sort of under the Biden administration is that people were expecting that to become more rational. Like, do you remember during the Trump administration, it was just, you'd wake up in the morning, there'd be 25 tweets and trade policy would have changed overnight. And it's sort of unclear where that was coming from a rational public policy perspective.
Policy by Twitter.
Yes, exactly. And so you know, that policy by tweet has stopped, but it's been very, very slow to thaw some of the trade restrictions that Trump put in. So yeah, I think that relationship is going to continue to have tension over time, but that doesn't mean that China's uninvestable. There's other things going on in China which make it a very difficult market to invest in right now. The macro, the property, the fact that there doesn't seem to be any clear pathway at all to COVID normalization. You know, those things make it difficult to invest in China right now. We don't have any direct investments in China, although we do have indirect exposure via companies like LVMH and Apple and Nike. So China's difficult to invest in right now. And we'll see what happens.
How big of a problem is China's property situation? Is it the next big tail risk event? It's all very opaque as of course, a lot of things are out of China.
This is one area where I would love to go and kick the tires. So if you, previously I've gone to some third and fourth tier cities and, to look at, remember there was like the whole ghost town thing and that China's property market had been totally overbuilt and there's all these huge high rises that nobody lives in. If you can actually go and talk to all the developers and go see their developments and, you know, talk to the banks about mortgage growth, it gives you a much better picture. But right now we're kind of getting like snippets and headlines about, you know, this company missed its debt payments and
tanks outside banks.
Yes. Well, you know, and these customers are unhappy, but you need to remember that like China is a huge country and there's 1.2 billion people. So if you have, you know, 50 outside a bank, it's really difficult to read that through, or I think it's quite dangerous to read that through to everything that's going on. So on the property, I think on the property front, there's probably like the haves and have nots, and there's going to continue to be a lot of problems in the more spivvy end of the development side, whereas the you know, high quality developers will be fine. I don't think it's a huge systemic risk to the banks. The banks are, I mean, they're primarily government owned, so they're very well capitalized. And it's not going to be like GFC 2.0 for China, which is, I know what, sort of one of the theories out there. It's a very difficult situation because similar to Australia or America or countries like this, if you have a huge fall in the property market and there's a negative wealth effect, then that has other effects too, to consumption, to equity market investing, et cetera. So it's a very opaque situation. We don't have any exposure at all to that part of the Chinese market.
Stepping back for a minute again to that juxtaposition between the United States and China, they seem very different these days, especially in terms of infrastructure. I've been to Shanghai International Airport and I've also been to LaGuardia.
Yep.
And the contrast is stark. And it seems like you can extrapolate that to you know, the rise of one and the decline of the other. Am I being overly reductionist?
No, it's funny you say that because, you know, you started by asking about the travels and I actually stopped in Hawaii on the way there and like Honolulu Airport is straight out of the late 1960s. Like that thing has not been updated at all. And, you know, I used to travel a lot to China. I used to travel a lot to India also. And then I went to LaGuardia and I was sitting there thinking I can name, you know, a dozen airports off the top of my head in emerging markets that are nicer than this one. And, you know, you drive through some of the cities in America and the infrastructure is crumbling. And it's not just physical infrastructure. Some of the social infrastructure looks a bit shaky also. I mean, we talked about the big tech companies in Seattle, but there's some serious social problems in Seattle. There's a huge homeless problem and the police have been defunded. It doesn't feel good. I can't think of anything more specific to say then it doesn't feel good. So I think that, yeah, that infrastructure, both the physical infrastructure and the social infrastructure, you know, there is sort of a crossover happening there. That said, post-COVID, there is a lot of stimulus still going on to address the infrastructure in the US. And the infrastructure in places like China and India and other emerging markets is going to continue to improve.
Is infrastructure spend a no-lose situation in terms of, you know, the multiplier effect infrastructure spend has on GDP?
So from like a economic theory perspective, that does seem to be the case. And especially, that does seem to be the case. But I'd say right now, like unemployment isn't a huge problem. In China, there's a youth unemployment problem, which is quite stark. I mean, youth unemployment is running around 20% right now. So that's very high, and that could cause political problems in the future. So if building airports and roads and stuff gives jobs to that age cohort, I think that's important. But where you don't get that multiplier effect, and China has been accused of this in the past, is if you're just building bridges to nowhere so that someone has a job building a bridge to nowhere, and then once it's built, you're not getting that sort of second order effect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. COVID hospitals that go up in 7 days.
Yes, exactly. And then nobody stays in them ever after.
Yeah. We're jumping across the pond a bit here, but in China, if you look to their big tech names, are those investable at the moment?
So we don't own any of them right now. Alphinity, as I said earlier, invests in companies that are in an earnings upgrade cycle and where there's earnings leadership. And none of those companies, certainly the big tech companies, are in an earnings upgrade cycle yet. In fact, a lot of them have been in a quite significant earnings downgrade cycle. Some of them because of regulatory changes in China, which have like literally chipped away at their earnings so that they're sort of consistently in downgrades. And then some of them more on the e-commerce or the economically sensitive side. China macro is just not particularly attractive right now. So they're also have been getting downgrades in the past. So, I know some people take from a regulatory perspective, these are uninvestable. From our perspective, it's more they're in a stark earnings downgrade cycle, and we need to wait to see if those turn around. But you were asking before about valuation. The valuation of these big Chinese tech names is very attractive. It has been for about the last 50%, so that's not a floor. Valuation is attractive, but I certainly would have to see those earnings turn around. And the other big thing on the Chinese tech names is what happens with this ADR listing. So names like Alibaba is probably the best example. If the SEC cracks down on this audit situation and they have to delist, that would be a big thing for the stock because a lot of the shareholders are still in the US. So just last week, you had some important news on that. China has decided to delist some of the SOEs, so the Chinese government-owned companies like China Life and China Mobile. And that is a step in a direction. I don't really know. I don't have a strong view whether that's saying that all Chinese companies are going to be delisted, or whether that's a signal that they're just going to delist the state-owned ones and then everyone else can get audited and stay listed. But in any case, it's a step in a direction. So that's a situation that I'm watching closely.
So where around the world are you seeing value in markets? Where are you putting your capital?
Yeah, so we have, I guess the first thing is that particularly in volatile markets, it's important to be diversified. So one thing that Alphinity doesn't do is bet the farm. So say Europe's fantastic, Europe's looking really cheap, we're putting 80% of the portfolio in Europe. Like, we would never do that. So having a diversified portfolio across geographies and across sectors and across different thematics is very important. So I think that's the first thing, is that right now, like always, it's, we have a diversified portfolio. We are seeing opportunities in the US, but more sort of on the defensive side. So some of the stocks that have done really well are sort of defensive growth. We've owned McDonald's, which has held up like a champ, like it always does in a downturn. I mentioned before a preference for sort of luxury. So stocks like LVMH have done very well. NextEra, which is it's a utility, but it's one of the biggest renewables companies in the world. We have a big position in NextEra. So it's not really identified this thematic or identified this country or this sector that's really inexpensive. Having a diversified portfolio and following that earnings leadership is how we're positioned.
Do you have much cash at the moment?
No, cash is not a sort of lever that we swing around, and other funds do that, and we may have 20% cash at some point and 0% cash at other points, but that's you're just making an overall market call. And so for us, cash is more like an output. So if we have or it sort of falls out of the bottom of the process. So cash is not something that we swing around a lot.
Let's move on finally to sustainability. And when people think about sustainability, they think of the environment, they think of carbon, but AI also features in that picture. Take us through it.
Yeah, so this is something where we've been doing a lot of work because, as you say, we have two sustainable funds, and we define sustainability as alignment with the Sustainable Development Goals, which is quite a clear and easy to understand definition. But within that, a lot of the environment related goals do get a lot of attention, and that is completely understandable. Everybody gets that. But if you look at the global benchmarks, they're dominated by big tech companies, and big tech companies generally have low emissions because they depending on the tech company, but as a group, they don't have big physical assets. They don't have there's not a factory somewhere that's pumping out Google searches or something like that. So they generally have low emissions. They're asset light. They're very cash generative. So they screen very, very well on some of these more environmentally related sustainability metrics, which is fine. And that's one of the reasons why, a lot of these stocks are in our portfolio, but that doesn't mean that there's no risks there. And, one of the things that we've talked about is, technological singularity, or sentience for AI. So the singularity, technological singularity, is like when we lose control of technology and they take over. Like,
I think there's a Johnny Depp movie about that.
Yes, exactly. There's a lot of movies about. I don't want to sound like a flake, but there's a lot of movies about it, and there's a lot of sci-fi about it. And if you actually listen to people like Elon Musk, Tesla has this Optimus robot that they're developing, which is very, very advanced AI, or if it comes to be, it's supposed to be very advanced AI. And he is very influenced by the Foundation series and a lot of this very early on sci-fi literature. So we kind of are laughing about movies and books, but they have informed some of this sort of in the early days. Anyways, if you think about technological singularity, or even technology becoming sentient, that's a big sustainability risk. Because if humans get that wrong, or the people that are developing AI get that wrong, a lot of the other sustainability things that we spend a lot of time thinking about, they sort of fall down the list in terms of importance.
So what does wrong look like?
Well, okay, this is an excellent question. And there's a lot of literature on this. So we're summing this up into a few short questions, but this is months and months and months of analysis. And not just, looking at what investors say. This is what think tanks have done. Academia is way further ahead than the investment community in terms of thinking like this. So in terms of, I won't say what wrong looks like, but this is what right could look like, or what sort of, we have a checklist of things that companies or investors should be looking at to think about responsible and ethical, sustainable AI. So one is that it's human-centric, so that it's made by humans for humans, and that the whole point of AI, people don't lose sight of the fact that this should be human-centric. The second is transparent. So where issues could arise with respect to unsustainable or irresponsible AI is if it's not transparent and you can't actually tell what's going on. Secure and contestable are other important things. And contestable means that, humans can change decisions. So if you have a robot or an artificial intelligence system that's making decisions, humans can sort of intervene and change that decision if it's irresponsible or unethical. Fair and unbiased, and then forward looking. So these are just some of the things that we have on our checklist. And if you look, as I mentioned before, at think tanks or academia or the thought leaders in this, those characteristics are actually quite consistent. And that's why we feel comfortable having them as part of our checklist.
Is it possible to have effective AI that does abide by these guardrails? It seems like some of these aspects are transparent. Can we develop AI and have it still be transparent and contestable?
Yeah, so there's a second part to the question, and that is for companies, and certainly for publicly listed companies that have shareholders, what are they disclosing? Because the first part of transparency is can we tell what's going on? And then there's secondly a governance aspect to it. So from the governance aspect, one thing that we found is best practice is that if companies have a committee, that their specific role is to look at AI ethics and responsible AI. And Microsoft is a good example of a company that has that kind of committee, and it appears to be working relatively well. Google also has that kind of, they had a committee, and they had a sort of a group that was responsible for that, and then two of the people on that committee came out with a report that they didn't like, so they fired them. So that's not a good example. But from that governance perspective, you know, similar to a lot of things in companies, from the outside, it's hard to tell. But if they have the governance structures in place, another thing we look at is whether the CEO understands these issues and whether they offer thought leadership on it or whether they're kind of out to lunch. So if you have a CEO that's cognizant of the risks here and you have specific structures, particularly a governance committee or ethics committee inside the company, then that goes a long way to giving us comfort. The second thing which we look at from a governance perspective is whether KPIs are aligned, because you know, we've had a lot of calls with experts and some of the people that work in this field say the hardest part is that there is constant pressure to commercialize AI, constant pressure. And so, you know, when you're thinking about it at a high level, saying, making sure that artificial intelligence is responsible and ethical, no one disagrees with that. But when you're at the coalface and you're being pushed really hard to commercialize this AI, it's a little bit different. So making sure that companies have KPIs where it's not just about commercialization at all costs, where there's some aspect of sustainability and responsibility baked into those KPIs, that's important.
From an ESG perspective, how are these things measured? They're extremely esoteric. We can talk in general terms about this stuff, but dig down to the next level and I'm lost. So from an investment perspective, how can these things be measured?
Yeah. So it's a good point. We distinguish between ESG and sustainability. So sustainability is alignment with the sustainable development goals. And then ESG is sort of operational risk from environment, social, and governance. And so AI usually pops up in the S part of ESG. And then the G part is what I was talking about before in terms of structures that can be in place to sort of manage the risks around S. So when we think about AI and the context of the S of ESG, I guess one of the important things is data privacy. Because like Alexa, you mentioned Alexa before, there's controversy around Alexa. Is like when you're talking to Alexa in your home, are they actually, you know, getting data about you and your family and what you're doing at home that's shared with Amazon or that's used to sell more products or used in a different way. So I'd say right now, and it's important to highlight, we are at very, very nascent stages of understanding the ethics of AI, like very nascent stages. So for right now, we look at it sort of on the data privacy perspective and on the ethical risks. You know, we have one of the criteria in our essay that talks about the ethics of the products that a company produces. So those would be the two areas in S, and then, you know, the governance structures that go around it would be a part of G.
Okay, Mary, we always finish the podcast with three favorite questions we always put to our guests. The first one, what is everyone getting wrong about markets these days? Or if not wrong, overestimating or underestimating?
I mean, we've talked a lot about China, and I think that, you know, a lot of people have just written it off, and a lot of people have written off emerging markets full stop. And I think that that is, you know, that's not the right outlook. One company we've bought in recently is Mercado Libre, which is the biggest e-commerce company in LATAM. And if you actually look at what's happened from a macro perspective, Brazil is like a year ahead of the US. So they you know, had runaway inflation. So they raised interest rates massively from like 2% to 13.75%. So that's just, you know, like incredibly fast. And, you know, unemployment went way up and they've had a bit of a credit cycle. But I'd say Brazil is sort of like a year and a half ahead of where the US is. So people have completely written off US emerging markets. And I think that that's probably a mistake.
What's a big win or loss you've had in your career and what did you learn from it?
Oh, in my whole career. Okay, well, this is going back quite a lot. I mean, I'll give you a very recent one just because it popped into my head. So we did own Netflix, and that was one of my stocks, and that was a mistake. And we talked about it a bit at the beginning in terms of the divergence of the FANG stocks. And Netflix, I mean, the business model, there's a big question mark over it. And, you know, we bought it at the time, you know, remember Squid Games was like, mm-hmm. had just come out, and people thought the Netflix content slate Flight was so amazing. And so it was going to continue to drive user growth. And
it's blank check.
It was blank check. And that, that was wrong. That I was totally wrong on that. There's a disconnect now between, it doesn't matter if you have a great content slate, you can still have negative user growth, even if you have amazing content. And so that was, I got that wrong and that was painful, but we got out of Netflix. It's actually a good example of turning a mistake into a positive thing. We follow earnings leadership and Netflix had a huge earnings downgrade and the business model may or may not be broken. So we got out literally on the day and it fell like another 45, 50% after that. So acknowledging when you make a mistake and getting out is it's better to make one mistake than to make one mistake and continue to make the same mistake over and over and over. So I guess that would be a recent one that I would highlight.
How do you know when to pull the trigger and crystallize some losses? Or if not crystallize some losses, get out of a position that you think will go sideways.
So, Affinity, it's very clear the kind of companies that we're looking to invest in. They have to be in an earnings upgrade cycle. They have to have that earnings leadership. So if you have a company that has a downgrade and that downgrade is, not a one-off. So sometimes, particularly during COVID, you'd see a company or, during all these lockdowns, well, we just couldn't do business or it's a one-off. Then you don't have to get out of the company for that reason. But if it's very clear that a company's in an earnings downgrade cycle, you just have to be unemotional about it. Just cut the ties. So I found that being unemotional and not falling in love with stocks is a really good thing over time.
I think that's the headline of this podcast. Don't be wed to your stocks.
Yeah.
Okay, finally, if markets closed for 5 years and you could only own stock in one company, what company would that be and why?
I would probably say Apple because, if you look over time, I was doing this analysis recently, actually, in the last 20 years, it's outperformed the benchmark in, 18 of those years. And so if you're telling me you have 5 years where you can't do anything, the fact that you can find a company that outperforms in up markets and down markets, that sounds like a pretty good bet.
Not Microsoft.
Yeah. So Microsoft is also an amazing company. And, we particularly like the cloud business in Microsoft that continues to, do very, very well. Either of those would be fine. I think I'm quite a fan of some of the big tech companies. And I think that there's, something we haven't talked about is that there's a whole sort of theory out there about that the world's has become winner take most or, winner take almost all sort of environment. And so you have these really big companies in the world. And when the going gets tough, these companies generally take market share. So I don't know what's going to happen in the next 5 years. But I'm comfortable being in these very high quality stocks. I guess that's the first thing to highlight. Whatever I'm going to put in for 5 years is going to be high quality because I don't know if markets are going to be up or down or what's going to happen the next 5 years. So make sure that they're very high quality and that there's high moats around the business. So whatever happens, they can continue to show that leadership and continue to deliver on earnings.
Do you think it's winner takes all or do you think there's always room for two in a market, as the saying goes?
So that's why I say winner takes most or winner takes almost all. From a regulatory perspective, it's very rare that you're going to get someone who's allowed to have a monopoly. But what you've seen in many countries when it comes to technology or even some of these big consumer brands, that there is something in the market that makes it easier if you have a big market share to continue to take market share. I guess the best example right now is Google. So if you look at all of Google's competitors in the, MSCI GICS sector is called communication services, Snapchat, all these kind of, they've all blown up and they've all been saying, Facebook even, they've all been saying that, ad revenue is terrible, shocking macro headwinds. We can't operate. And then Google comes out and they beat every quarter. And you're like, how they're operating exactly the same environment. How can this be the case? And sort of my theory that I've come up with is that Google is the last thing that people will cut. If they're going to cut their ad revenue, they will cut everything else, but they're going to keep Google. So that means in a bad environment, Google's actually gaining market share in ad revenue. And that means that at the end of the day, it's even stronger. So, I think there is a case to be made that the big get bigger. And so if you're an upstart, if you're small and trying to get your first bite of that market share, it's very difficult.
Mary, thank you so much for coming on Rules of Investing. It's been a great chat.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's it for today's episode. Global markets are very messy at the moment, but far from uninvestable, with some extremely attractive valuations to be had. For more daily content like this, be sure to sign up to livewiremarkets.com. We'll see you next time.